Before we start, I'm sure many of you have now heard the name George Floyd, an African-American man who died in police custody in Minnesota last week. Tomorrow, Anushka will bring you an episode about his death and the protests that have erupted across America as a result. But first, today, is it the right time to be further lifting lockdown restrictions in England? Going to a restaurant, having a haircut and shopping for clothes. As Europe has begun to emerge from lockdown, people have been trying to get back to some sort of normality.
So this is the first time I'm venturing out tonight for an aperitivo. So I've got a mask, bought a new mask today, hand sanitizers at the ready. Not sure it's worth applying any lipstick, but I did anyway.
For The Guardian's Rome correspondent, Angela Giuffrida, that meant meeting friends for dinner for the first time in weeks.
And now, oh my God, so this is my friend Rachel. We haven't seen each other for almost 3 months.
I'd seen the way the staff have been preparing for opening over the few days before, and it was incredible. You know, they disinfected the place. Obviously, the owner had to get in all the masks. There weren't the normal menus. There was like a barcode on a bottle of wine, and you just put your phone up to it and the menu came up.
This is the chef. This is the chef.
I know that I will have in front of me very difficult time, but I'm ready to fight again.
We had the kind of, you know, mix between euphoria about the, you know, some freedoms being restored, but also there's still a lot of anxiety. Even when you're out, you feel that you really have to keep your guard up, and it's hard sometimes because you start to relax a bit and then you have to pinch yourself, you know, and actually, you know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. You can't really relax into the rhythm of normal life.
Angela is not alone in feeling conflicted about the easing of restrictions. Yesterday, England followed European countries in lifting lockdown rules again, with groups of 6 now allowed to meet up, and those who have been shielding can leave their homes for the first time in 2 months. But health officials and even scientists advising the government are warning that this loosening of restrictions could lead to a surge in cases which the country is unprepared for.
What you really need is a package of interventions, and we're really far off on that, and we don't really have good enough data systems to be able to monitor at the local level. So it's a big risk and gamble. We're exiting lockdown with a larger number of deaths than we did when we actually entered lockdown months back.
The ONS survey suggests we're maybe getting something in the region of 8,000 new infections every day in England, and just in the community. That's
you will have heard that the R level is between 0.7 and 0.9, so it's only a bit below 1. So we've got very little headroom, actually, and it's really important that we use that headroom very wisely and we don't lose control again.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, is it too early to be lifting lockdown restrictions? David Hunter, you're a professor of epidemiology and medicine at the University of Oxford, and you've written for The Guardian about how we can contain coronavirus. And Europe is opening up at the moment with people going back out to restaurants and sunbathing on busy beaches. What is it like for you to watch that happening at the moment?
It's scary. They have had a bad epidemic in Western Europe, particularly in Italy, Spain and France. And I completely understand why people need to get back to work. I completely understand why people are tired of self-isolating. Even though they've knocked their numbers down a lot, there's still virus circulating, and it's almost certain that there'll be flare-ups. The question is, can we control the flare-ups, and have they got the systems in place in those countries to control outbreaks that will inevitably occur?
For a few weeks now, we've heard about the R number. It's what the government are following very closely as a guide to lifting lockdown restrictions.
And that COVID alert level will be determined primarily by R and the number of coronavirus cases.
We're constantly keeping the R under review. And it is one of our 5 tests is for R to be below 1.
But can you actually explain what it is?
So the R, in one sense, is a very deceptively simple concept. It's the reproduction number. So it's just the average number of people an average infected person passes the virus to. So if the R is greater than 1, the epidemic will grow exponentially. If it's less than 1, the epidemic will eventually disappear. At the end of an epidemic, when you've got all of the data, you can calculate what it was like at the beginning of an epidemic, what it was like in response to interventions. It's actually quite hard to use the hospitalization statistics to get a very robust estimate of the R. And in any case, because there's about a 2-week lag between infection and hospitalization and a 3, 4, or 5 week lag between hospitalization and death, you're really looking into the past to calculate what the R was several weeks ago if you use those data that we collect routinely. So we're almost always monitoring what the R was several weeks ago and then trying to infer what it is today.
And is that what is happening in England? Who's calculating it here?
So many groups are calculating it. I think the best data is coming from the Office of National Statistics. They are now on their website providing updated information. And then a lot of the academic groups use that. And all of this gets supplied to the newspapers that often show maps of what the R is in various parts of the country.
As you can see, the R rate in London is now by far the lowest of all the English regions. With the exception of the Midlands, every other region has an R over 0.7.
The key thing for people to know is that this isn't like the weather. You know, we can't just look out the window and see what the R is. It's a quite complex statistical calculation that has potentially quite a lot of error.
And around where is the R number in the UK now?
The government is estimating that it's somewhere between 0.7 and 1.
We have the R below 1, but potentially only just below 1.
1 would mean that the number of infected people doesn't change over time, which would mean that the number of people being hospitalized and unfortunately the number of people dying probably wouldn't change much over time from where it is now. If it's 0.7, that would suggest, if we could keep it at 0.7, that it would gradually die out. But it takes a lot longer to die out than to flare up. And again, coming back to the fact that the R is a sort of number you can apply to the whole country, but the estimates from the government is that it's actually quite low in London right now, maybe 0.4. So if you could seal off London and you could keep it at 0.4, in a matter of months, you might almost have London virus-free. But in other parts of the country, it's 0.8, 0.9, and it's sort of hovering very close to the number of 1. And it probably would make a lot of sense to lift the lockdown slower in some areas than others. It's more of a political decision, I think, whether that's something that the public will tolerate.
What do we know so far about what can control the R rate and keep it down?
Things we can do in our everyday life are actually quite effective. So washing our hands, the self-isolation and stay-at-home orders obviously has had a huge and dramatic impact. The disease modelers, the people from Imperial College, for instance, have estimated that essentially within days of the so-called lockdown order, the R fell from some number like 4 to below 1. Wearing masks, closing schools has an impact. And the question is, which of these interventions is going to keep the R below 1?
And what makes the R number go up? Is it so-called super spreaders, like the man in South Korea who infected a large group of people after visiting bars and nightclubs?
A growing coronavirus outbreak in Seoul. Nearly 120 cases of COVID-19 have been linked to a group of bars and clubs, and secondary transmission is now on the rise. The first patient in the cluster was a man who visited 5 bars and clubs earlier this month.
So it turns out that it's likely that most infected people do not infect anybody.
Really?
We can calculate that early in the epidemic, up to about 80% of people were infected by less than 10% of people who are carrying the virus. So that is the other way that we can knock down the R. if we can just not have events where large numbers of people gather in an enclosed space, if we can really stop these potential super spreader events, that would go a long way towards keeping the R under one.
Okay, David, you've explained what the R rate is and why we need to keep driving it down if we want to eventually eliminate the virus. In areas of England, the R rate is still hovering near to one, and yet the government is easing lockdown restrictions for the whole country. There have been a number of health officials and scientists warning that this is happening too soon, and I think the public feels quite confused about how to follow the new guidance safely. For example, we've been told we can meet up to 5 people from other households. They can come into our gardens, but they're not allowed inside unless they're passing through or using the toilet.
These changes mean that friends and family can start to meet their loved ones, perhaps seeing both parents at once or both grandparents at once. And I know that for many people, this will be a long-awaited and joyful moment.
What's the safest way to navigate situations like this? Is it more important to meet with fewer people, or is it about staying outside as much as possible?
So personally, I feel that the 2-meter rule is reasonable. I think if you're outside, that greatly diminishes the probability of droplet transfer. The reason that we're being asked to only do that with family members or one other household or do it in limited numbers is precisely because of the concern that even outside, even sitting in a circle 6 feet apart, there could still be transmission. And so the government, I think, wants to do this cautiously, which I understand. Of course, if someone's outside in the garden, they need to go to the loo. There's still the probability that the virus can survive on surfaces for a matter of hours. But I think meeting outside, wearing masks 6 feet apart is, in the scheme of things, a relatively safe thing to do.
And schools have now partially opened in England, but do you think the government has forced this a bit quickly?
Primary schools in England will begin readmitting some pupils this week amidst warnings from teaching unions that it's too soon. Parents of nursery, reception, year one and year six pupils will be able to choose whether to send their children back to school.
Other countries who were badly hit, like Italy and Spain, have not opened.
So the school situation is probably the most complicated situation there is. From a pure infectious disease point of view, I think anybody would tell you it would be preferable to keep the schools closed. Having said that, some of the modeling suggests that children aren't a major vector, and we need schools for all of the other reasons we need schools. If people are going back to work, schools are essentially the way we do childcare for a big piece of the day. So I think the smart thing to do probably would be to wait a little longer, but the government has decided differently, and they get advice that has to accommodate many, many more elements than just the infectious disease dynamics. I think the important thing to do is to make the schools absolutely as safe as possible, to not force anybody to send their kids to school if they're uncomfortable. It's possible to stagger entry times and have a couple of shifts, but I don't see a lot of schools economically perhaps able to do that. So there's still more things we could do, perhaps.
After this, to lift lockdown restrictions, you need a test and trace system. But is the UK's capable of containing an outbreak? But first, Today in Focus has been nominated for 3 British Podcast Awards. And yes, you guessed it. We need you to help us win in the Listener's Choice category. You can vote for us at britishpodcastawards.com/vote by typing Today in Focus into the search bar. Thank you. The other words that have come up to form a regular part of the lifting lockdown vocabulary at the moment are test and trace.
How can we get back to doing more of the things that make life worth living without risking safety or putting lives at risk? NHS test and trace is a big part, not the only part, but a big part of the answer to that question.
How does the system work?
So for most infectious diseases, this is just routine public health activity. It's usually done at the local level. And for diseases like HIV, for diseases like tuberculosis, If we find a case, we ask people who they've been in contact with, and we get in touch with the people who've been contacts, and we either test for the disease or we warn them to be careful about that disease. And the government has decided to do this in a much more centralized way. So the way it's supposed to work is that there's a big contract to a company that runs a call center, that as they are informed of the name and phone number of somebody who's tested positive through one of the testing channels, I'll have to tell people who I've been in touch with, and then there'll be an attempt to contact them. So you can see that it's incredibly reliant on two things. One is very fast turnaround. If you don't get back to me within, let's say, 24 hours of a test, if it takes more like 3 days, then that's three more days that I could be out there unwittingly spreading the virus. And the other thing it relies on is people to actually answer their phones when they get a call from a contact tracer. Quite how we work out who's a scam and who's a legitimate contact tracer, I'm not sure. But if someone does get a call from a legitimate contact tracer, it's important to answer the questions honestly. And then it'll be very important for people who've been in touch with someone who's turned up positive to self-isolate for 14 days. And it's going to be important to have a wide variety of social supports, of income support, so people are incentivized to do that. And there's a lot of anxiety these days that with some loss of trust in the government because of everything that's happened.
You're referring to Dominic Cummings.
That's right.
Calls for the British Prime Minister's top advisor, Dominic Cummings, to resign continue to grow inside Boris Johnson's own party. The journey Mr. Cummings made during lockdown to isolate at his parents' farm in Durham with his family continues to draw fire despite his lengthy public explanation yesterday.
No, I don't regret what I did. As I said, I think reasonable people may well disagree.
Events of the last week have suggested that not everybody in government does the right thing or the honourable thing. But even before that, I think there was concern that the numbers we were being told about the number of tests were being exaggerated. And all of this has led, I think, to some scepticism. The polite way of thinking about it is the government doesn't really know what they're doing and is trying to catch up.
And yesterday, a YouGov survey revealed that many members of the public have lost faith. And it showed that half of British people now trust the government to provide accurate information on the pandemic, which is down from 2/3 in April. And then on top of this, we're told that this test and trace system won't be fully operational until the end of June. When this eventually does get up and running, will it be effective?
Conventionally, it works best at the beginning of an epidemic when there's relatively few people infected, and at the end of the epidemic when there's relatively few people infected. Right now, with about 8,000 people infected every day, that's the Office of National Statistics estimate. Even if we're only finding a fraction of those, that's several thousand people for whom the whole test, track, and isolate system needs to work. And that's a lot of people. We've frankly never done anything on this scale before. So we're learning as we go. And because of that, the Royal Society panel estimated that on its own, test, track, and isolate might reduce the infection rates about 15% at this point in the epidemic, and that things like hand washing and self-isolation with symptoms are still much, much more important things to be doing to drive the R down.
I think one of the questions everyone wants to know the answer to, David, at the moment is how likely is it that we will experience a second wave of this virus?
We will experience a second wave. The question is, how does that wave look? Is it another tsunami? We sincerely hope not. And I think it's reasonable to expect that with the measures in place, and unfortunately with the possibility of going back into lockdown always as an option, we should be able to prevent a wave as big as the first wave.
And if this comes back in winter, will it be worse?
So there's two ways of answering that question. One is, will the virus change and be worse? And that's a theoretical possibility. Often viruses actually become a little less contagious and less lethal. But from a non-virus perspective, from a population perspective, every autumn and winter we get outbreaks of either the seasonal flu, other coughs and colds. And that's because we tend to be indoors more, we tend to be outdoors less. And so you would predict that if the virus is still around in the late autumn, the conditions are there to see more spread than they would be, let's say, in July and August.
But by then, might we as a population have developed some sort of immunity to this virus?
Again, that's the hope. And that was the early rhetoric around herd immunity. So if we get to about 70 or 80% of people having become immune to the virus, then there'd be very few people to be infected. And so the virus won't spread nearly so fast and might actually die out. The problem is that the estimates from the antibody tests are saying that even in the worst parts of London, maybe only about 20% of people have experienced the infection, and that nationally it's more like 5 or 6%. So that's nowhere near enough. And to get to herd immunity on that basis, we'd have to go through several more rounds of what we've been through, and nobody wants to see that happen.
Lots of ifs and lots of hope at the moment then, I suppose, David.
We have to hope that everybody will understand that I need to protect you. That means wearing a mask. That means not forgetting myself and shaking hands or hugging. And that's going to have to persist for many, many more months. And we have to hope that the government will get this right, that the response will be broad and nimble.
Do you have faith that they'll get it right?
I hope they will get it right. We can only hope.
David, this has been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You can read David Hunter's opinion piece about lifting lockdown at theguardian.com, where you should also read Why I Quit Working on Boris Johnson's World-Beating Test and Tracing System, an account by an anonymous and now former contact tracer. Thanks for listening. Today's episode was produced by Sam Colbert and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back with you tomorrow.